pale eyes. "Oh, I know who you are, madam. 'Tis only that your keeper's name is no good here. He's a bill a foot long to settle up."
"For pity's sake, it is only cakes," snaps Angelica. "The miserliness of tradespeople. It is quite astonishing. Do you not agree, Bell?"
Those others in the shop, respectable ladies, turn to peer discreetly at the set to, and less discreetly as it goes on. "Cakes," said the server sternly, "that have gone unpaid for since November. Not to mention 3 jars of peaches in syrup, 39 jellies, and their glasses, not a one returned, 1 fancy Savoy biscuit measuring 3 feet high, 7 cases of macaroons, and gills of fancy liqueur numbering," she pauses to draw breath, 13 in total. "The entire sum owing is £15.08.
"Is that all? For £15 you subject me to this?"
"If I allowed everybody to dodge their bill in such a way, where would I be?" Angelica sighs.
"Clearly there has been some oversight, and more likely on your part than his. Very well, then, put it in my name. I shall have my woman settle it up."
The woman shakes her head. "If he cannot pay his bills, I deduce he cannot pay yours. Or have you income from other pockets, too?"
"How dare you?"
Bell touches her arm, her face downturned.
"Hush, Jelly," she whispers into her stock.
"Certainly not. Did you mark what she said?"
Angelica's voice is high and shrill and resonates through every cloche and tile. The company of sweet eaters is beyond concealing its interest. Gentlemen and women sit rapt.
"How dare you, madam?"
Angelica repeats.
"If you do not have the coin," says the woman, "I cannot help you."
She places her hand on the half-filled tissue, and the paper crunches. Angelica's pockets contain a notebook with ivory leaves, a miniature deck of cards, a tin in which to collect errant pins, a small mirror in a case, a portrait miniature of dear Georgie, a length of red ribbon, and a bottle of rouge. They do not, however, contain so much as a single dusty halfpenny. She has got so out of the habit of keeping money about her that she has almost forgotten its physical form. It merely drops from her lips as a casual flow of promises.
"Why do you expect anybody to carry cash?" she demands. "That is very revealing of your class."
"I have it," says Mrs. Fortescue.
"Oh, Bell, no."
"Comes to 2 shillings, says the woman.
"For the biscuits?" asks Bell softly, opening her purse.
"No, no, I shall pay the balance."
She darts before Angelica to lay the coin on the counter. Angelica's ears look as if they have taken a dab of cochineal themselves. They are so unnaturally scarlet. A film of liquid wavers across her eyes as she watches the sugared parcel tied off with a length of red string. Then Mrs. Fortescue presses it into her hands.
"A gift," she says.
"It must be a mistake,"
whispers Angelica as they leave at pace.
"Surely a mistake."
But she finds her hands are quivering and her brow cold with sweat. She remembers her wretchedness after the Duke's death was reported in the papers and his credit useless in shops, the bitterness in the back of her throat, and the fluttering of her heart, as if her terror had become trapped in her bosom like a bird in a chimney flue. She remembers also an accident, she does not mean to recall it, once being small for her age, and walking the high street of the town where she was born, with the buildings tall about her. The counter of the butcher's shop, when she entered it, came to the height of her nose. The smell of blood and rancid fat.
"Got any bones?"
"What's that, little miss?"
"Bones. For the pot. Just bones. Anyone's will do."
You Morgan's girl, ain't you? So, your daddy's not come home?
He's making our fortune.
Oh, I. And how will I make mine, if I give away all my scraps? Not good business.
I don't want much.
What you got? Not a coin on you? Now, surely you have something you'd be willing to trade. No, a girl's always got something.
And the world heaves.
Easy, dear, easy now.
Mrs. Fortescue has her arm around Angelica's shoulders, murmuring in her ear as if she were a frightened horse.
Take a moment. Take a breath or two.
She gasps in air, feels better for it. She keeps her chin down, for the street is busy, and she's afraid to be recognized while in such distress. Presently, she composes herself.
"Shall we go home?"
asks Mrs. Fortescue. "My house is not far."
"No, no! This need not spoil the day."
She attempts a little laugh, which Mrs. Fortescue pretends to find convincing.
"This one uppity shopkeeper, that is all. Let us go on."
"But perhaps
deduce nothing from this."
Angelica blots her forehead with her handkerchief.
"Stay out with me, Bill. I never see you nowadays. Take me to your favourite jeweller's. I want something pretty to wear for Mr. Hancock. Diamonds, I think, and solely for my own satisfaction. He won't know them from paste."
"Perhaps it were better if you hired a piece," Belle soothes her, "or I shall lend you something of mine."
"No, I do not hire diamonds. I do not borrow them, as if I were some sitz wife allowed to her one mask of the season. Come, Belle, I wish to buy something lovely. Rockingham is good for it."
But each shop they go in, they meet the same response. A discreet shake of the head, a draper running his finger down his ledger and saying sadly,
"Madam, it is out of my hands."
Rockingham's name is not good in one single establishment along the length of Bond Street.
"I do not know what has happened,"
Angelica says, quite numb with the shock of it, once they are back in the sealed cabin of her new carriage.
"Sincerely, I do not. Perhaps somebody has a vendetta against him."
"Somebody has simply tired of paying his bills," says Mrs. Fortescue. "If they ever did."
"Oh, no, that can't be so. He has an allowance, you know. That is what we live on."
"An allowance which comes to no more than what? A boy like that, 500 a year, I'd wager. And you have a bill for 100 at the jeweller's alone. See sense, Jelly. He has no means to pay anybody off."
"Christ."
Angelica puts her head in her hands.
"No, no. He has the means. He's kept me most comfortable. I have nothing to fear in the world."
Mrs. Fortescue raps on the roof of the carriage and leans out.
"Twice round the park,"
she calls to the groom. She closes the window tight and takes Angelica's hand.
"My dear, those are exactly the sort of things they say."
"Not Georgie. You patronise me, Belle. No, 'tis true. Do you believe you're the only one who has a good keeper? I am at least as loved as you are, at least."
There is a great deal of gentleness in Belle's brown eyes.
"Very well, yes. He is a young man who's got into some financial trouble. Who has not? This can be resolved."
"How?"
"That's his trouble, not yours."
Angelica dabs at her eyes.
"Oh, where is your feminine liberty now? I must simply resign my fate into his hands?"
"I believe you did that the moment you took his word as sole assurance that you need not protect your own interests. Jelly, Jelly, do not cry any more. I did not mean to upset you."
But if you've made yourself a chattel, his spending is hardly your responsibility. Nobody blames the coach and four if a gentleman cannot keep up his payments on them. Angelica gasps.
The carriage,
she whispers with awful urgency.
This very carriage we now ride in. Hush! Do not let our driver hear a word of this, or else he will eject us onto the pavement, for I fear his wages cannot be paid.
Oh, now, Jelly, you do not know it is so bad, says Mrs. Fortescue. And besides, no hireling would throw you over so abruptly. They know a little discretion.
Hush! Hush! Lower your voice, Belle!
Angelica is hugging herself with worry.
As for discretion, they don't trouble themselves with it once the money's gone. You saw how loudly that woman denounced me in the shop. It will be the same all over. I know how it is.
She digs her fingers into her upper arms so tightly the knuckles whiten.
They positively triumph at one's misfortune.
Mrs. Fortescue pats and shushes her, but she frets on and groans.
Oh, this is grave. This is very, very grave.
For the full awfulness of the situation is creeping chill into her bones. Here she is, alone with his debts, and no word of when he will return.
He cannot have expected this.
She looks appealingly at Belle. Her friend hesitates.
No, dear. No, he cannot.
Oh, if only I could speak to him. I would be so much easier if I only knew his plan, if he'd left me more cash.
I can give you...
No!
Her poor cheeks flame scarlet.
I have too many gowns. I will have Eliza pawn something for the time being.
If he were here with her, he would reproach her for her lack of faith.
Oh, but she has been so faithful. She permitted herself, for once, to believe his every word. Is this where it leads one?
She feels Belle's hand on her back.
Do not think the worst. When he comes back...
Angelica's handkerchief is soaked through. She fishes for another, and here is Belle's pressed into her hand, embroidered with her husband's crest. She blinks and blinks again as the tears waver across her vision, gazing upon the lovely coronet, the unfamiliar letters. Then she screws it into her hot fist and hies it to the floor.
Foolish me, she says, making such a meal of this. Why, all I need to do is write and acquaint him with my situation. He will be mortified to hear of it. I am as faithful a mate to him as he is to me. We are matched souls.
But in the meantime, if you need help... Angelica has now entirely left off crying.
If you really mean to help me, you will leave off your naysaying, she snaps. You have not uttered one encouraging thing throughout this entire sorry episode. You assume the worst of him at every turn.
I meant only to be prudent. You would not be the first lady to have her trust abused.
You see? You cannot simply be glad for me, not for one second.
A certain tightness goes out of Belle's figure. Her shoulders droop, and although the slump in her mien is barely detectable, slump she most certainly does.
All the years of our friendship, she says in a little voice, I rejoice at your rejoicing. When you weep, I weep with you.
Then why are you so at odds with me now? Rejoice! Rejoice for me! I am the best I've ever been!
They complete their journey in silence, and at Mrs. Fortescue's house, Angelica will extend only the most muttered and insincere of fare-you-wells. If she had guessed that this would be the last ride of its sort, that they will not meet again under such circumstances, would she have discovered more warmth for her old friend? but she does not watch Mrs. Fortescue go, and rides home without a backward glance. Chapter 16. Meanwhile, Mrs. Chapel has rushed to the house at Portland Square, where Polly has been vanished more than 12 hours. The Christmas greenery and stars still adorn every surface, but the doors to even the smallest cupboard are all flung open, and there are men searching the attics and knocking at the walls in search of secret compartments. Mrs. Chapel is crumpled and irritated and overhot after her one-mile voyage across the city, for she hates to be harried about. She takes one look at the uproar and hurries Eleanor into the library for a private interview and a glass of watered spirit. Even that closet is decked with branches of yew and mistletoe, most pathetic in light of the aborted festivities, which only heightens Eleanor's state of panic.
"I helped Paul choose her stays," she now sobs. "And she said, 'Now, how many pairs of stockings are you taking?' Well, I'd best take double what you do, for I mean to dance all night." "She packed 12 new pairs of stockings, madam, and they're all in our trunk still."
"As if that signified," snorts Mrs. Chapel.
"She bought all 3 volumes of Evelina," insists Eleanor,
who is struggling with the peculiar sensation that she cannot get enough air into her lungs.
"Nobody who means to leave on the first day takes all 3 volumes.
"Stop crying," says Mrs. Chapel. "You do yourself no favours."
"But I knew nothing of it,"
Eleanor wails.
"I believe you," says Mrs. Chapel,
a magical incantation guaranteed to start any tongue flapping.
"But you must be sure and tell me all you know. You were the last to see her."
"I and all the gentlemen,"
Eleanor persists.
"All the gentlemen. We were in company from 7 o'clock until she disappeared."
"And then what?"
"I've told you."
"Tell me again."
Eleanor wrings her hands.
"It was about 10,
she says, and sets about pacing up and down the little room as if she must chase from one recollection to the next.
"Or half after, or 11, perhaps. And we had dined and took a drink, and to be sure you remember what a fine clear night it was, though very cold."
And here she hesitates, doubts herself, stumbles onward more shrilly.
"At least it was fine here. I do not suppose the weather is much different in St. James's, though I have heard before of showers in Whitechapel, where it was quite dry in Threadneedle Street, so who can truly..."
Mrs. Chapel clicks her fingers.
"Blathering, Nell. Pray, back to your story."
"The men will attest that the weather was just as I recall, and they said, 'Why do we not go out onto the terrace and look upon the garden?'"
"Were you drunk?"
"I, madam? No, madam."
"But Polly is inclined to drink, and in her cups she becomes reckless, does she not?"
Eleanor looks at her cautiously. Which is the better reply?
"You think..."
She stops, but her thoughts are a burst of panicked birds wheeling in all directions, and she is short of breath as she darts to catch hold of them all.
"Well, she's no sort of drinker, but now you cannot think her actions were calculated. And perhaps she did not go willingly. All the wassail may have gone to her head. If Polly came to be repentant, what would you..."
Her palms are wet. She clenches her apron in her fists.
"You could forgive her, surely."
"But she has not returned," says Mrs. Chapel.
"She may be in some trouble," says Eleanor, "that we do not know of."
"What trouble could ever have come to her? She's been kept safe, has she not? As all of you've been. She has wanted for nothing, and I have given her my protection without stint.
She may have been kidnapped, says Eleanor. Gypsies?
She adds, hopefully.
Kidnapped? For what purpose?
Oh, madam, such terrible things happen in this world. When a young girl with a good face disappears in such a way, 6 times out of 7 it transpires they've been drugged and carried off by terrible old ladies who debauch them and keep them captive, and then sell their honour and profit by it. This is a daily occurrence in this city. No girl is safe from it.
Mrs. Chapel snorts.
You never were an observant child. Kidnapped? Cast the notion from your head. She went of her own accord.
But why would she simply leave?
She's thinking, but why would she leave me? She is thinking, but I did not know we had such secrets from one another. She is thinking, but our lives were identical. I did nothing that she did not do. Why then was she so dissatisfied when I was not?
She begins precipitously to sob.
I know nothing, madam, nothing at all of this matter.
Chapter 17.
You ought never to have let him up in the first place, says Mrs. Frost, knotting the last tie of Angelica's gown.
I do as I please.
Angelica has no intention of telling Mrs. Frost anything of Georgie's financial oversights. Her reaction would be beyond tolerating. Even so, it pains her when her companion demands,
And your protector? Does he have no claim on your heart?
Mrs. Frost circles her, minutely adjusting the gathers in the muslin. Her disapproval does not extend to leaving them less than perfect, as very well she might.
He has sole claim to it. He has no rivals for it. I only have the gentleman up because I'm bored, criminally bored.
You think nothing of propriety, said Mrs. Frost. You must always be entertained. Sit down. There's more to be done to your hair.
You are forgetting I have no propriety.
Angelica throws herself into her chair and leans her elbows on the dressing table, knocking trinkets and boxes without care.
I lost it long ago, and thus I am at liberty to be alone in rooms with strange gentlemen.
She sighs.
You are no model of virtue yourself, Eliza. You know where your bread is buttered, that's all. I never saw you take Georgie's side until now, when you believe your living depends on it.
How dare you! I've been nothing but virtuous. Rectitude is ever my watchword. It wounds me to see you break your promises with such little provocation.
Shut up, Eliza!
For this lecture is hardly to be tolerated either.
No, truly. I should like to see in your behaviour some inkling of female decency. But I begin to think your appetites are baser than they ought to be. I had thought you more restrained.
Angelica casts her eyes to the heavens.
I'm only taking your advice, she says, remembering myself to the town. I do not closet myself away from those who might one day be of use to me.
Now is the time for closeting, says Mrs. Frost. You jeopardize our position when you...
Are you finished here?
Angelica rises abruptly from the table. In doing so, her hair delivers a soft clout to Mrs. Frost's chin, but she affects not to notice as she whisks the powdering cape from her shoulders.
Yes, I think I look very well. You have dressed me very fine. That is what you are good for. I go now to await my visitor.
She stops before the mirror, smooths her dress.
Oh, by the by, I would have you pawn a gown or two. My soul protector keeps us so very comfortable.
You are vexed today, he says.
I? And what if I am?
She slumps on her sofa, picking at the varnish on its scrolled woodwork, and the light from the window touches one cheek, but not the other. Now and then she turns her face towards the glass, a despondent little gaze that lingers on and ends finally with a sigh, and which puts him in mind of Suki when her friends do not call by for her.
There is a great deal in my life that is vexatious.
He shrugs. You may be as you are. I'm not so cheerfully disposed myself. And this is so. He slept badly. Since the unicorn completed its creep along the west coast and struck out past Ireland, he has had no word from Captain Tyso Jones. It being such an unusual voyage, he cannot guess when next he might have news. But the coldness of the winter has sown dreams in his head of crooked and cured mer-children. They squawk to him from dark cradles. When he looses their swaddling, he finds their little bodies crushed to a handful of dead leaves.
What can be wrong in your world? She asks.
Well, what is wrong in yours?
She scowls.
No mermaid, for one thing.
Patience, he says shortly.
A virtue I have very little of today.
She looks again towards the window.
Forgive me, sir. I have a great deal on my mind. I am waiting for something. It may never transpire, but my fortune depends upon events that take place far away, which I can neither know anything of, nor do a single thing to alter.
I have lived all my life that way, he says.
She looks at him askance, purses her lips.
Well, I am not used to it. If it don't happen under my nose, or by my own hand, why ought it to affect me?
Providence, he shrugs. We live in a great world, but may only see one tiny corner of it.
I cannot be at ease with it.
She begins to bite her thumbnail, then takes it from her mouth guiltily and slaps a cushion instead.
Why nothing in the meantime?
She demands.
Can you not acquire me some little amusement now? No mermaid. Why not the skin of a selkie? They can be got in Scotland very easy. There is nothing to prevent you.
Oh, no, he says. I could not give you that in good faith, for then the poor lady would never return to her kin.
I don't care, she retorts. It's a luxury few enough of us have in this life.
A movement from the back rooms catches her eye, and she breaks off. Here is Mrs. Frost scuttling through, clutching several gowns to herself, their skirts hung over one arm, their jackets the other. He sees the bright chenille border of the flower garden Angelica wore when they met first.
You see,
says Angelica,
there go my sealskins.
What's she doing with them?
Mrs. Neal looks away. What expression is on her face, he cannot see. But some of the animation leaves her body.
Oh, she says,
and any light that was once in her voice is fading.
They are to be laid up in lavender.
She smiles then, as if she has solved a problem, and returns to her seat. Her arms are spread on the cushions, wrist upward. Her skin is white and her veins are lilac.
I have so many gowns this season, she continues. I cannot fit them all in here. There is simply not enough room for all the luxuries I possess. Besides, she tips her head back so her pale throat shows, I tire of them.
Mrs. Frost snorts, which she does not much like, but she is already out of the door.
I am taking them to her uncle's.
She calls mockingly over her shoulder.
Pay her no heed, snaps Angelica. She's sent to vex me. Or perhaps it is vice versa. She does not like me much of late.
I did not know you had an uncle in this city. You said you had none.
She grimaces. It is a turn of phrase.
He stops and thinks. Oh, I see.
He steeples his fingers. Are you comfortable in your household economy, Mrs. Neal? Are you amply provided for? He knows he should not have asked. So perfectly does her face close up that he would not have been surprised if it had been accompanied by the sound of a slammed door. Her body closes up too. She buries her hands under the fold of her shawl, but he can see the nervous movement of her twisting fingers.
Forgive me, he says. It was indelicate.
You would not have asked that of any other lady, she says.
No, I believe I would not have.
But is this not Mrs. Neal's very problem? Since their last meeting, he has been nagged by the thought of her as an ordinary woman, and once a girl as deserving of protection as his own Suki, or Bridget, or any daughter of straitened means. She is a woman out of place, this Angelica Neal, a piece fallen loose from a great machine. Her concerns are not those of other women.
I should not have opened my mouth, he concedes.
Aye, assuredly you should not. She rises, dropping her shawl onto the sofa. I find I have forgotten an engagement, Mr. Hancock, and am very much delayed in my preparations for it. I must ask you to take your leave of me.
But he does not move. He dares instead to keep watching her. No, he says. You are distressed. What is your trouble?
She shakes her head, but her lip is quivering, and her eyes one wink away from overflowing.
Now come. And he drops to an ungainly knee beside her couch.
But Angelica has pulled down her chin, and her shoulders are quaking.
I do not mean to cry. She hiccups. Do not look at me, sir, I beg you. Or pay me no mind.
He cannot think what to say, and there is nothing to do but decently avert his eyes from her evident embarrassment, all the while patting her arm and hazarding expressions of bland comfort.
I know, he says. I know. 'Tis a hard thing to maintain oneself in this world, a very hard thing.
Until she wilts altogether, her back bent and her head in her hands and her shoulders heave with awful sobs.
There, there,
he whispers, placing his hand more firmly upon her sleeve. And while she does not raise her head, and her tears fall afresh into her lap, her hand creeps out from beneath the tumble of her hair and rests, trembling, upon his own. Chapter 18. There is a knock, and the secretary of Mr. Hammond, whose house party has been so sadly spoilt, puts his head around.
Mrs. Chapel, he says, and bows. What news?
None, she grunts. And there'll be none until I've finished interviewing my girl.
So make haste, he says,
darting a quick look at Eleanor's tear-stained face.
You must appreciate a situation of this sort is most distressing for all involved. Not the atmosphere one wants for a celebration. Puts a bad taste in the mouth.
It is hardly on me, says Mrs. Chapel. I have lost a valuable asset.
Quite so, quite so, but we will be expecting our money back.
Money? Quavers Eleanor.
Yes, miss, says the secretary. 200 guineas. I have a good mind to ask for the entire sum returned, for there is no coming back from this. The week is ruined.
Now, no need, says Mrs. Chapel.
It may seem so now, but I shall send another girl. This will be swiftly forgotten. I assure you, there's nothing like a little music and revelry to restore good humour to any party.
200 guineas?
Asks Eleanor in stupefaction.
Vulgar, Eleanor, snaps Mrs. Chapel. The money is the thing of least significance.
100 up front for her, 100 for you, says the secretary. And the same sum to be paid again if the thing went off to my master's satisfaction, which of course it has not. Well, I shall leave you to decide between yourselves how this may be made good.
And he brisks away. As the door clicks to behind him, Nell turns to Mrs. Chapel for verification, wiping her eyes with her knuckles.
I had not thought it would be so much. Were we to see any of it?
The cost of living is very high, says Mrs. Chapel.
Well, but 200 apiece. Surely you...
And it is brought no lower when girls make off with clothes that do not belong to them.
The board continues.
What dress did you say it was? The white, with spangles? That alone cost me 5 guineas. Then petticoats, 15 shillings, stockings, 1/2 crown, then stays and shoes and shawl and pockets. What was in her pockets, by the by? Coins, I'll wager, to say nothing of her jewellery. It all comes to, well, over 10 guineas worth of apparel she has stole from me. Twice that, perhaps.
Oh, come, not stole, says Eleanor.
Then what? She has taken what is not hers. Those clothes were my own property. Oh, this is a beast of a situation we find ourselves in. Polly was an excellent earner and an asset to the house. How could you have let her get away?
I?
Eleanor trembles.
I never would have, if I'd known.
And I shall never find her on my own.
Mrs. Chapel rests her chin on her fist.
If she has made her way into the streets, she may as well be lost forever.
Then she raises her head to meet Eleanor's eye.
But with this man Hammond's aid... His father knows every constable in London.
What are you going to do?
Quails Eleanor. She wants very badly to go home.
Oh, Paul, you've brought great trouble upon us.
Light a fire under them, says Mrs.
Chapel.
Oh, dear, don't start so. I mean figuratively. Have him come back in. I know how to persuade him to find her.
Nell totters to the door, rather numb, and finds the secretary helping himself to the hothouse grapes piled without. When he comes back into the room, Mrs. Chapel has drawn herself very upright. Only Eleanor sees the way her right arm, propped on the table, trembles to support her pose.
"Here, sir," the board barks. "Tell this to your master, that I hold him responsible for the loss of an excellent servant."
Oh, when they wish to go, they find a way.
She's never expressed a desire to leave before. She was always quite content. Miss Bewley here can vouch for that.
Eleanor nods weakly, and Mrs. Chapel continues.
I cannot help wondering whether something untoward happened to her here.
She raises an eyebrow.
There is also the matter... of the items of valuable clothing she fled with, which it is reasonable to expect him to replace.
You cannot propose. This is my master's responsibility.
Why not? It is due to his negligence that she's vanished.
The secretary is baffled. Now, madam, she is your employee. She holds up her hand.
I'm not yet done speaking. I expect from Mr. Hammond the full account owing on her, by which I do not mean only the cost of the items she took with her or the sum he agreed to pay for her, but also the debts she ran up with me.
Perhaps you do not apprehend that since this young woman came into my care 2 years since, I have clothed her and fed her and trained her in every one of the arts that so delighted your master. You think all that can be effected at no cost to myself? You think I do this for the fun of it? £400 I have invested in Miss Campbell's care and education, and not a penny of it has she paid back. So how will I recoup it?
Apprehending his expression, she shrugs.
One of your young bloods would demand no less if I had mislaid one of his racehorses. How is it different?
They stare at one another. The severity in Mrs. Chapel's face is startling, her mouth hardened to a mere crease in her face, her small eyes very bright. Eleanor, daring to turn to the secretary, perceives that he is not entirely composed. He turns his face away too quickly and makes for the door. When he reaches it, and his hand is safely on its knob, he says, "She is a servant." Then, growing in bravery as he swings it open and sets one foot into the hall, "Not even that. A whore. And if she has robbed you, well, you should have expected no more of her." Mrs. Chapel does not so much as twitch.
"The debt is your master's," she says coolly. "Do you risk making an enemy of him? He knows the men who wink their eye at your disorderly house." "On whose authority do you threaten me?" she asks. "I am protected. Always have been."
"I would not be so certain," he says.
"If you can restore her to me, I shall have nothing at all to pursue," says Mrs. Chapel. "You tell your master that. It may yet all come to naught."
Eleanor's heart is in her mouth as he closes the door behind him. She turns to the abbess, who leans more deeply upon the table, and closes her eyes briefly.
"He was extremely displeased."
"Pah! And what does it signify? He don't make the rules."
She mops her brow with her scrap of handkerchief.
"All the great men know they are bound to please me more than I am to please them. There ain't a board in St. James's who matches the service I provide. We are safe."
"But what if—"
"No ifs."
Mrs. Chapel's joints ache and her chest is heavy. She admits to herself that this to-do has agitated her more than it might have were she a younger woman.
"Is it possible I have overshot myself?" she wonders. "I am not as nimble in my mind as once I was." "Polly," she sighs, "I would not have thought it of her. Well, she was always saucy, never as biddable as I would have liked, but to have stole from me, stole a gown, I would not have thought that of her at all."
"She had no other," wheedles Eleanor. "Pray, what was she to—"
"She was to remain in the house,"
thunders Mrs. Chapel.
"She was not to abandon my service, as if she were no better than some willful housemaid."
Her voice vanishes to a croak, and she subsides in her chair, her hand to her breast, panting painfully. Her face is ashen, her lips blued, and Eleanor takes alarm.
"Madam,"
she crouches beside her. The abbess's skin is cold and dewy, but her eyelids flutter over the rheumy orbs beneath.
"Do you need your salts?"
"Water,"
she croaks, and Eleanor pours it with terrible trembling, so that its dropples fall to the carpet and stain her slippers. Once Mrs. Chapel has sipped, coughed, sipped and gulped, she looks a little better.
"I'll have no more of your worrying, miss," she says. "You are to go out of this room
and make those gentlemen forget they were ever disappointed.
But Polly...
Leave that in my hands, says Mrs. Chapel.
Will she be got back?
You assume we shall be so fortunate as to find her. If she's gone into the rookeries, we'll not see her face again. And if we did, she would be welcome in my house no longer. You would do well to forget she was your friend.
He dreams one night of grey seawater, its surface leaping, its depth incomparable. Beneath its surface, very far below, he sees a black shadow, vaster than anything he can even conceive of. Its scale is not of this world. It is bigger than factories or mountains, bigger than the growing ships that tower over his little Deptford home. The shifting, tugging water obscures its shape, but its largeness is such that his breath aches in his throat and his fingertips tingle. And all the time, it is coming towards him. In his dream, this dark creature rises and rises up to the surface, its pace stately but gathering speed, until its shadow is all that can be seen beneath the water. It must shortly crash through the waves, scattering white wings of foam in its triumphant upsurge into his own realm, to loom into the sky and block out the sun. But before it does so, he wakes up. It is morning, and the room is full of pale light. The dream, hanging upon Mr. Hancock still, a heavy sadness across his chest and shoulders. He has seen his own smallness, the futility of all of his doings. He rubs his eyes, massages his sternum to ease the knot of grief that has formed inside him. When he sits up, he sees that there, by his bed, stands a grave, pale boy of 8 years old, his dark curls lying on his shoulders. Mr. Hancock cries out. He kicks the bedclothes aside. He reaches, grasps, his heart thundering. But nobody is there.
Chapter 19.
Mr. Hancock?
Mrs. Neal turns restlessly and lays her face upon her arm.
Were you ever in love?
He tugs at his cravat. He feels that Henry has walked beside him all the day, and many hours after waking, his mind is still so distracted that the word love on the lips of a beautiful woman puts him in mind of nothing that it ought, but instead lays in his arms once more the weight of his little boy, Henry, as he had cradled him that one and only morning. The child was already dead at that time, his poor blood crisping at the jag in his head that the instruments had made.
"That is scarcely a thing to complain of,"
the surgeon had said.
"Not his fault. Nobody to be blamed. They had paid for the best. If the infant had been any faster stuck, I would have been obliged to bring it forth in pieces. Be glad you've something to honestly bury."
And that was something to be grateful for, was it not? For despite his wound and his lips going greyer and his tiny shoulder strangely crushed, this long-awaited Henry looked as perfect as any living child. Mr. Hancock remembers Henry's shawled body in the crook of his arm, as if he carried it there still. He thinks, "It will be the last thing I feel before I die." But he can say nothing of this to Angelica, who knows, after all, no atom of such suffering. So he knuckles his brow and,
Yes, he says. I had a wife. Mary was her name. That is a long time ago.
And what happened to Mary?
He says not a word.
Forgive me,
she says.
It ain't my business.
He is about to nod and turn his talk to other things, but then he thinks of how she had so unwillingly wept before him, the memory of which he has been holding at arm's length since last he saw her. He never speaks of Mary, certainly never of his son, but he has seen a tender part of Angelica Neal's soul, one she would not have volunteered to him, and it is in this spirit of transaction that he offers her his own story. "We were married 4 years," he says, "and were very content, but we had no child, though we sorely desired it. And when she at last took one, there were no two more joyful people than we." Mrs. Neal puts her fist under her chin, listening. It is too late for him to stop. He feels as the boys who line up on the jetty on hot days to fling themselves into the still and tepid water. He remembers well how it was to jump, the moment his feet left the boards and the time stopped to nothing, and he knew that there was no altering his trajectory. His heart quickens. He has not spoken these words often enough for them to have lost their sting, and to recount his loss even at the distance of 15 years is to relive it. "This story does not end happily," he warns her. "Mrs. Hancock was brought to bed, and she laboured for days, but finally she was tired and could do no more. Perhaps she was too old." He tries to smile. "But women a good deal older than she labour safely every day of the week. Perhaps it was her physiology."
"Some women are ill-suited," says Mrs. Neal sympathetically.
"If I had known it, I would have put all thoughts of children away from me and been grateful for our lot."
Poor Henry, whose face was swollen and cruelly bruised, his eyes closed in a perpetual frown, keeping to himself the secret of whether they were to be blue or brown or grey. Were it better that he had never been conceived at all?
"Oh, no, but you cannot have foreseen. Well, what happened?"
"There's no more to say. I buried my wife and my son. I'm glad they lie together."
"I had hoped the child had perhaps lived," says Mrs. Neal.
"And where would you be now, Henry Hancock? A young man, slender like his mother," Mr. Hancock thinks, "and most assuredly with her dark hair, for he already had it on the day he was born." "Yes," he thinks, "he would have gone to the Navy." And this is a happy thought, and proud. If he had lived and grown, he would not now remain at his father's side. The pain of parting would have been delayed, but never avoided. It may be that at this moment Henry Hancock is not dead, but only very far away, with the breeze of a foreign ocean stirring those brown curls. "Some say that in such circumstances it were better the child died," he says, "leaving me free to start my life anew."
"Not I," says Angelica. "A living child is always good fortune."
She furrows her brow and casts the full light of her blue eyes upon him.
"These are very sad things that have befallen you."
"No worse than anybody else's lot."
"Maybe so. That is not to say it does not cause you pain."
"I'm advised to forget," he says. "But if I did not have the pain, I would have no memory of them at all."
Her face is still cupped in her hand. She sits up straighter and says,
"Shall I tell you my opinion on it?"
He is never to hear it, for at this very moment the door flies open and all the room is taken up by the gentleman in the blue coat. He is very handsome. He looks at Mr. Hancock and says only,
"Get out."
"Georgie," cries Angelica, "what are you about?"
Rockingham seizes Mr. Hancock by the arm and pulls him to his feet.
"Leave,"
he says. His face is so close, Mr. Hancock can see the white cap of a pimple glowing on his chin. Turning back to Mrs. Neal, he says,
"What am I about, when you have brought a man in here?"
"I'm doing nothing wrong. We're only sitting, only talking."
She looks to Mr. Hancock.
"That's so," he says. "I meant nothing by it." "You give them your society," he spits. "That is how it starts. You told me so yourself."
He turns again to Mr. Hancock.
"You fool. What do you think she can do for you?"
"I'm leaving." He backs from the room, hands raised. "I'm leaving. Think no more of me."
"And what have you to say for yourself?"
Mrs. Neal cries.
"Sending me no word. Troubles that I was by no means prepared for. You who abandoned me."
She has begun to gabble now.
"So what can you blame me? Another soul to hear my unhappiness?"
She darts a glance over her shoulder to Mr. Hancock on the landing.
"Which cannot be borne alone. Listen to me, sir. You and I have a great deal to discuss."
As Mr. Hancock retreats, the door to Mrs. Neal's apartment slams. On the street, he looks up again. Her windows show nothing. But he thinks he hears her voice, talking anxiously on. Chapter 20.
"It should not have been like this,"
she says, composing herself, for if she is not conciliatory, all must be lost.
"I had plans to celebrate your return, Georgie. You ought to have sent me word you were coming."
He throws himself onto the sofa, and it shuttles back some 6 inches with his weight.
"And give you warning?"
he mutters. But the retort has no spirit to it.
"Something is amiss," she thinks.
This is a knowledge she has held concealed from herself for some time. There is no disowning it now. She comes to sit beside him, but he looks up at her with such a peculiar expression that she stops short.
"What is wrong?"
she asks. But before he can draw breath, she stumbles on.
"If it is about the bills, I already know."
She takes her place next to him, but she feels at once that the small ways in which he holds his body and responds to her movements have changed. She cannot say it, but she knows. Still, she blunders.
"But it will be all right. I'm not angry. It was just a horrid, a very slight shock. If you'd warned me, I would hardly have been upset at all."
"I'm giving you up," he says.
"No,"
she says.
"It is hardly your choice," he snorts. "If I am leaving, I am leaving. It is merely a case of my walking out of the room."
"But I..."
She wishes now that she had not let Mr. Hancock quit the room. Then he would have had no polite opportunity to say these words, or if he had exploded, it would have been for another reason, swiftly explained away. All would have stayed just as it was.
"About the money," she ventures. "We can find a way."
He is shaking his head and snorting as if she were absurd. She has never known such coldness from him.
"There is no other way than this. Do not reason with me. You will look a fool."
"But how can you leave me?"
she demands. She would like to choose the safety of rage, but she needs his favour too much to show anything but the most even emotions. She takes a breath and touches her hand to his cuff.
"I am as good as your wife."
Her fingers tremble there for one aching second, then two. It is all the sensation she has. She is praying that it may stay there for ever. But he draws his arm away.
"No," he says. "You are my mistress, and you are immoderate in your spending, and intemperate in your demeanour, and in short, you have ruined me. I cannot pay the debts you have run up."
"With your permission, it is your recklessness as much as anything."
He stands.
"I need a woman with a fortune, not one who will leech me dry."
Please, George.
She lowers her voice.
Talk to me. Is this your choice or your family's? Do they wish you to marry someone else? For, you know, that is not insurmountable. Nobody is faithful nowadays. You need not relinquish me.
He stares ahead, impassive. He has learned from Mrs. Frost that Angelica cannot tolerate being ignored. She gabbles on.
I shall make no demands on you. I shall not be jealous. We might carry on as we did before.
We might, he says, if I were not sick of you. She can say nothing to this. Inside her, there spreads a great emptiness, which is better, perhaps, than feeling.
Then I have no argument, she says carefully. I suppose your family will pay your debts.
As if it is any of your business.
They ought also to pay mine. You promised to keep me, and you bade me pass my bills to you. I had no knowledge at all that I was living on tick.
They're debts in your name, ain't they? You take care of them. Do not tell me you have forgotten how. She does not remember what else he says. She is at one moment entirely numb, and also in agony, as if great fists were twisting at her viscera. She knows she follows him about the apartment while he collects the last of his possessions. Mrs. Frost, returning from an errand, looks on impassively. It is she who sees him out. Angelica goes to the window and watches him as he strides the length of Dean Street. The flower girls and draper's assistants and beribboned whores approach and lay their hands on him or walk alongside him a little way. But he never looks back. She watches until he is out of sight, with a blacking at the edges of her vision and a rush of cold all across her body, as if she were drowning. She might be lost at sea. There is a great cold void beneath her, and she fears she is not strong enough to avoid being sucked under.
Am I dying?
It may be so. She closes her eyes and swallows hard. Then she pulls away from the window and says aloud,
No. No. This won't do.
And so, to action, she goes at once to her dressing table and whisks open one drawer after another to seek within them their finest pieces, the necklace of Milfiore medallions, her golden armlet, the earrings set with rubies. She takes out her patch box and his snuff box. She seizes the best of the candlesticks and the books and ransacks her box of lace to choose which cuffs and fichus she can best do without. She sighs mightily as she does so, for every scrap she seizes up is as delightful to behold as it was the day she chose it. The beauty of each stitched flower and star and swag is enough to make her ache. She had not tired of owning them yet. The glee that they are really hers has not abated, and yet she is packing them gently into a basket to be taken away.
Eliza,
she calls.
Help me.
When Mrs. Frost comes to the doorway, she hands her the basket.
Pawn it, she says. Sell it. Whatever is best. And this. And this.
Is this necessary? Asks Mrs. Frost.
You keep the books. You tell me.
She is rummaging through a drawer full of fans, throwing them onto the carpet one by one without looking at them. Then she starts on the linens.
They will call in their debts if they know he has left me, and I have no way of paying. It must be hundreds that I owe, thousands. There will be bailiffs.
She wheels around, her skirts heaving. Her composure flees her.
Must they find out? Perhaps they need not know.
She paces the floor, twisting her fingers relentlessly, and her speech ascends and ascends into hectic gibberage as she continues.
Oh, perhaps if we ask him a few weeks' grace to let nobody know he does not protect me, he might find it in his heart, if he understood. I shall go away for a while. The countryside... Where?
Her agitation is such that Mrs. Frost becomes almost afraid.
She will do herself a mischief, she thinks,
and to still her, seizes her